NPR News, Accra.
A Syrian human rights group is reporting more than 750 civilian deaths since the uprising in that country began more than 7 weeks ago. Amar Kurabi, head of the National Organization for Human Rights in Syria, also says about 9,000 people are being detained in connection with the anti-government protests. President Bashar al-Assad recently intensified a crackdown on dissidents in an attempt to end the uprising. The Libyan capital is reeling from a series of NATO airstrikes against Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's forces. Local residents say that at least four targets in Tripoli were hit, including a building used by military intelligence agency. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jani Scott, author of the new book about Barack Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, called A Singular Woman.
She was a thoroughly unconventional person who dared to do things that many of us don't even try to do now.
Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. For someone who made a living disrobing in public, Gypsy Rose Lee gave very little away. Life magazine said that she was the only woman in the world with a public body and a private mind, both equally exciting. This morning, in this hour of Focus, our guest is Karen Abbott. She's the author of a recent biography of Gypsy Rose Lee. The title of her book is American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. It's published by Random House. And it does indeed tell the story of America's most famous exotic dancer, whose best talent, says the author, was becoming whatever America needed at any given time. Our guest, Karen Abbott, is also the author of a previous bestseller that set in Chicago in the Gilded Age. Sin in the Second City is the title of that book. And you can hear a conversation that she had with Celeste Quinn about that book. It's on our web archive if you'd like to check it out. And of course, here this morning as we talk with Karen Abbott, questions are welcome. And Ms. Abbott, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. It's a lot of fun to be able to talk about the life of Gypsy. And I guess, you know, one of the things I would have to say going into it is that while I would have said, well, I certainly have heard of Gypsy Rose Lee, and I had some idea what her life was all about, I had no idea just how celebrated and how famous in her day she was.
Yeah, I didn't either, and sort of that's what intrigued me once I started looking into this woman, and the fact that in 1940, the same, you know, she was declared the most popular woman in the world, even outpulling Eleanor Roosevelt, which I thought was remarkable. And then, of course, I came upon correspondence, a telegram from Eleanor Roosevelt herself to Gypsy that said, "May your bare ass always be shining." So here is a strip teaser. Somebody, as you know, you said earlier, who became best known for taking her clothes off, cavorting with the former first lady, with the Algonquin Roundtable, with gangsters, with socialites, with famous artist Salvador Dali, and here's somebody who appealed to everyone at once, and managed to do that in a way that until the day she died.
And to describe her as a strip teaser, which certainly was accurate, though, that I'm sure will bring certain images to people's minds. To say that wholly underestimates and only describes in a kind of a surface way what it was that she was and what it was that she did.
Absolutely. This was somebody who was determined to expand her parameters. I mean, this is somebody who grew up, you know, when she was young, and this is as she was portrayed in the musical and on Broadway. You know, she didn't have any talent. Here was somebody who was on the vaudeville circuit only because her sister June was a dance prodigy. But Gypsy, and she was called Louise as a young girl, she couldn't sing and she couldn't dance, but she was determined anyway to become rich. You know, when she was a young girl, June Havoc, who just died last year, I was the last person to speak with her. She told me that Gypsy used to doodle one word in her notebook, the word money, over and over again. So she had this really single-minded focus. You know, her greatest talent was being Gypsy Rose Lee. Her greatest talent was this creation that she fashioned. And she was always striving to expand the parameters of that creation. She had a very interesting, complicated love-hate relationship with this creation. And one of the things she wanted to do was become taken seriously as an intellectual and be taken seriously as a writer. And, you know, she published articles in The New Yorker. She published two novels. She produced a play for Broadway. And, she wrote her memoir, which became the basis for the greatest American musical in history. And even with all that, you know, she is still best known for being a stripteaser, albeit one who didn't always take it off.
That's I guess, is precisely the point. You know, I think about if people have probably seen the musical or maybe seen the film that was made of the musical, maybe they'll remember there's a point in the story where early on the young Gypsy is being instructed by some of the women who are the older strippers, and the theme, it's a very funny song, and the theme of the song is you have to have a gimmick.
Yeah.
You can't just take your clothes off. You have to have some bit of shtick that you do, and it's a really funny song. Well, she indeed had a gimmick, which was pretty unusual. So what was her gimmick?
Well, I think what really made Gypsy stand apart, and you know, the people who saw her said back in the 1930s when she first rose to prominence, said they had never seen anything like her, and they probably never would again. This is somebody who, you know, a half century before Madonna, understood how to make performance out of desire, and how to exploit that very human instinct that we're always going to want most what we can't have. And she talked to the audience. No other stripteaser had ever talked to the audience, and she injected humor into sex. And she brought a tease into the act and a sort of wry, she was a very sophisticated self-satirist and had this really contagious delight in the comedy of sex. And no one brought that really sort of high-mindedness to strip-teasing. And that's what really set her apart, the fact that here is a stripper taking off her clothes who's referencing Cézanne and Oscar Wilde and all of the high, you know, most famous literary novels of the day. You know, who else was doing that while they were also simultaneously taking their clothes off? It was something that people thought was really novel and smart and earned her the name the intellectual stripteaser from the Algonquin Roundtable back in the 30s.
And that's if people would like to have a kind of a G-rated sample of what this might have been like, if people go to YouTube, you can see a clip. She was in the film Stage Door Canteen. It was a film that was made in during World War II about this famous place where entertainers would go to entertain the troops. And there's people, a lot of famous actors have cameos in this thing. And so there's a little bit of a thing that she does. So you can get a little bit of a sense of what the act was like.
Yeah, and that was actually a very abbreviated and cleaner version of her most famous routine. It was called The Psychology of a Stripteaser. And again, how many stripteasers, you know, referencing psychology and referencing Freud in their acts. And this was a great piece of satire and a very, you know, self-aware spoof. And it was all about, look at the rigorous education I had to go through in order to take my clothes off. I had to study ballet in Moscow at the age of 3. I had to go to Paris and study the finest works of art. I had to read all the classic literature. I had to go to college at Sweetbriar just in order to take my clothes off properly for you fine people. And so that's the gist of that, and it became her trademark routine.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Karen Abbott. She is the author of the book American Rose, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee, recently published by Random House. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Just a moment ago, you invoked the name of Madonna, and I guess that I do indeed think about Madonna, and I guess what I think about is the Gypsy. It is a very American type of character, not in the sense that she is a self-invented person, someone who as you say, perhaps had something of a conflicted relationship with this character that she invented, that she played,
yeah.
And someone who certainly we have men and women who have done that both, but she is one that really stands out, and that doesn't seem so surprising to us today, but stands out as being somebody who she was Madonna before there was Madonna.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of the things I think that makes her story endlessly appealing and timeless. I mean, this is a classic Americana, and it's the strangest rags-to-riches saga you're ever going to hear. I like to call it, you know, Horatio Alger beats Tim Burton. I mean, it is classic Americana with plenty of unexpected dark turns and twists along the way. And by the way, things that she very deliberately omitted from her memoir and from the Broadway play. And so it was great fun trying to get at the real story of this woman and her figuring out all the revisionist history that she had put out there. But she is a timeless character. And I was trying to think of who to liken to her today besides Madonna. And it's sort of, you know, if Lady Gaga and Dorothy Parker had a secret love child, it would have been Gypsy. you know, she was relentlessly self-inventing. I found out recently that Lady Gaga is actually obsessed with Gypsy Rose Lee, which I thought was fitting. You know, Gypsy used to arrive on opening nights at the Met wearing a full-length cape made entirely of orchids. And, of course, Lady Gaga showed up somewhere wearing a full-length cape made of meat. And then recently showed up wearing in an egg, again, with the theme of self-reinvention and self-rebirth. So you can see that everybody who follows that really that provocative playbook is drawing from Gypsy Rose Lee.
Yeah, well, certainly, I think probably what a lot of people know about her, what they think or know about her, does indeed come from the musical Gypsy, which was partly, I guess, very loosely based on her life and inspired by her memoir. But if people have seen that, then I'm sure that what they focus on is probably the most famous, if not most infamous, stage mother of all time,
yeah.
Rose Hovick. And it seemed what you have done is look into the life of the real Gypsy and the real Rose. And if anything, the real Rose was a whole lot nastier than this character that we've presented with in the musical.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Gypsy admitted as much in interviews, you know, and with her sister, she talked, obviously she and her sister talked quite a bit about their mother. And she, you know, said, if I put the truth out there about mother, you know, I thought the only way to write about her was to make her funny and to make her a punchline. Nobody wanted to read about a character who was that awful to her children. Of course, I think that's fascinating. But in terms of a Broadway play and making it palatable to that sort of audience, that commercial audience, she thought the best way to go was to make her mother funny and make her a punchline. And so she's presented in that production as a sort of eccentric, slightly unhinged woman, ambitious, but who was not a monster. But this woman was really mentally disturbed in real life. The Broadway play doesn't even come close to scratching the surface of who this woman was. You know, and Gypsy had to survive this woman. She turned her daughters against each other. She fed them on $1 a day while she carried $30,000 in a bag around her waist. She seduced men and women in equal numbers for all sorts of nefarious purposes. She threatened to blackmail Gypsy later on for every dark thing that Gypsy had done before making it big. And this woman literally killed, you know, more than once to get her daughters on stage. So there's quite a more complicated picture of Rose Hovick that I talk about in the book that people might be familiar with from the musical.
Yeah. Well, that I guess one shouldn't be surprised then that both Gypsy and her sister would grow up thinking about maybe the number one thing on their list of things to do in their life would be get away from their mother, and then also to be able to live in a more comfortable circumstance than what they experienced when they were growing up with her.
Yeah, you know, and June said something really interesting to me. She said that mother was the love of Gypsy's life. And in a way, that was true. You know, Gypsy didn't have the accolades of the audience as a young girl. She didn't have the adoration of the audience to feed her the way that June had. And the only person who fed her when she was young was her mother. And her mother ingrained in her from a very young age not to trust anyone but mother. Mother was the only one who cared about her. Mother was the only one who was looking out for her. And it took Gypsy a very, very long time to realize that maybe her mother wasn't always, out for her best interests. And maybe her mother was pulling her down more than she was, being a assistance to her and a support system for her. And it took Gypsy a long time, even after her mother, began blackmailing her and these letters that her mother would write, these really volatile back and forth letters. I there's a line in the book where I try to sum up the relationship, and it says, theirs is a primal connection that was impossible for her to sever. It was parallel to love and just as deep, but rotten at its root. And so you can imagine that sort of codependent relationship that Gypsy had, had quite a time trying to extricate herself from.
Yeah, it was this very strange thing where she one minute her mother could be telling her just how much she loved her daughter and how important she was and how she was everything, and then turned right around and said, "Oh, by the way, if you don't send me some money, I'm going to go out around telling people about a lot of really terrible things that you did."
Yeah, and Gypsy didn't understand. I think that Gypsy treated her mother as best as she could, considering the circumstances, and she just didn't understand when her mother would turn against her, especially when her mother's own record wasn't exactly squeaky clean. They had secrets on each other, and it was this sort of, they couldn't afford to turn on each other in some way. And Gypsy was terrified of her mother exposing her for some of the early dark days that Gypsy had done. She was working very hard to cultivate this intellectual image, and she didn't want her mother ruining that for her.
Yeah, and both Gypsy and her sister did not write their accounts of their lives until after their mother was dead.
Yeah, I think they both thought that was the safest way to go. And her mother knew that Gypsy was planning to do this, and she even said things like, "Oh, I'm the laughingstock with all your fancy friends, and I'm the punchline, and oh, you're so much smarter than me." And her mother, constantly was threatening to, blackmail Gypsy and even sued her. There was, when Gypsy wrote her novels, one of her novels was called Mother Finds a Body. And this was slightly autobiographical, and you could imagine her mother's reaction to that.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers here. Why don't I go ahead and bring them into our conversation? We'll start with somebody who is in Lovington, and that's the first, and I believe line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Back in the mid-60s, I was living in the L.A. area, and I remember her having a kind of a talk program on TV at that time.
Yeah.
And she would do interviews and things with people. And I found her to be an absolutely delightful woman.
Yeah.
And one thing that has stuck with me all over these years, and I was glad to hear you clear it up for me, she made the statement to a guest one day. The guest said something about her dancing. And she says, "Oh, honey, I don't dance, but I sure could strut." and I just found that it has stuck with me through all these years, and I always wondered if that was true. So I'm happy to hear you clarify that for me. But she was delightful as a host on that show. I enjoyed it immensely, and that's all I wanted to say.
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if there's Karen, anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, actually, her talk show, I think it was when she was the most comfortable with herself personally and professionally. I think that it's toward the end of her life. She died in 1970. So this talk show was one of the last very public things she did. And I think she had finally achieved a measure of peace with Gypsy Rosalie the person versus Gypsy Rosalie the creation. And she really enjoyed that talk show and felt free to speak about anything, everything from her son, who was in the military at the time, to the results of her latest facelift, to how to make these beautiful lampshades out of tin cans. She was very crafty. And she just had a great time with that talk show and ironically appealed to middle America in a way that she had never before. All these people who were protesting her movie career in the 1930s at 20th Century Fox because they didn't want this movie studio to be featuring films starring a stripper, and a huge boycott arose. All of those same people then became her biggest fans during this talk show in the 1960s.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a quote here, and I think what this came up in a conversation that she had with Mike Todd. Now, maybe I'm misremembering this because I did write the quote down, but it was something to the effect of that she said, "What I'm not doing, it's not stripping, it's comedy."
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was central to her. You know, her act was, she considered herself a comedian. And she was very meticulous in where she put her laughs and where the audience would laugh and writing these lines that guaranteed laughter. And interacting with the audience in funny ways. You know, she would take a bow from one of her pasties and put it on top of a man's head and turn him around to the crowd and say, "Oh, darling, look how pretty you are," and you know, get laughs that way. And her act was all about comedy and making and finding the humor in sex. And I thought that was really interesting. She was sort of an accidental sex symbol. This was not somebody who was a highly sexual person who presented herself as such. And I think that in order for her to make sex funny, she had to have a certain distance from it. And she had to be asexual in some ways. So she was an accidental sex symbol and really did consider herself a comedian.
Another caller here, Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Though I am a bit of a curmudgeon, I'm not old enough to have ever seen her. But I'm under the understanding that what she did really isn't the kind of striptease that we think of today, where it's total nudity. She just really kind of suggested total nudity, didn't she?
It's an interesting question. And back in her early days, you know, she was just as naked as everybody else, especially before she became famous at Minsky's. You know, there was a year in her life where she didn't really like to talk about it. I spoke about this year with both her son and her sister. And it was after Vaudeville had died, and she and her mother were on the road alone, and they were desperate. They were eating dog food to survive, and Gypsy was forced to do things against her will. And her son intimated that one of those things was prostitution. And the really seedy burlesque clubs at the time, if you were working in there and if you went to see there, you were considered to be a prostitute, and the customers were considered to be johns. It was just the sort of norm for those places at the time. And so I think in the very beginning she was. But when she became Gypsy Rose Lee, when she became the creation, it's true. She did become more famous for the tease. And in fact, she invented something called the Inside Out Strip, which became a trademark for her. And she would come out on stage wearing this great billowing Victorian costume, you know, large hoop skirt and this great flowery blouse and a big hat. And she would begin, you know, stripping, but in a way that nothing happened. You would see the stockings peel down. You would see a garter belt fall off. A bra would fly out. And she would peel these things out from beneath the big Victorian costume. And so all of these things were coming off underneath, but on the surface, the Victorian costume was still intact. So she was indeed stripping, but was completely as clothed at the end of the performance as she was in the beginning. And there, that was the inside-out strip.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So we talked about her famous mother and her relationship with her mother. Tell me about her father, Jack. What sort of relationship she had, or did she have a relationship with her father?
Well, that's an interesting question. Rose Hovick, the girl's mother, divorced Jack Hovick, the girl's biological father, when they were quite young. They were 3 and 1 years old, and I actually begin the book with a scene of Rose Hovick on the witness stand discussing all the reasons why she deserves to be divorced from Jack Hovick and receive, you know, such and such amount in alimony. And one of the reasons was that he'd never bought her enough underwear. And one of the other reasons was that, you know, he would not play for private dance lessons for his daughters. Jack Hovick, she got rid of him in quite terrifying fashion. He is not one of the dead bodies in the book, but she did send him a sort of Don Corleone-style message that Jack Hovick heeded and disappeared. He was terrified of Rose Hovick. And Gypsy so didn't really have a relationship with her father growing up, and it was only when she was an adult later on that she reconnected with him and with his second wife and with some half-brothers and sisters. And sort of forged a relationship with him then. And there are some lovely letters from her father in Gypsy's archives at the New York Public Library.
Well, when Rose took the girls on the vaudeville circuit, was that something that was born out of necessity, or was that part of some actual plan that she had to have them? And I guess when I say them, really, it was Baby June that was the big star in the beginning to have them become big stars.
Well, Rose had always entertained the ambitions of being on the stage herself. There's a part in the book where when she was 12 years old, her father indulged her for one summer and let her go on a vaudeville troupe. And she did this all summer, and she loved it. And she always threatened to run away and rejoin the vaudeville troupe. And she never got on stage again after that, you know, that one summer, and so fixed her ambitions on her daughters. June always said that if her sister, if Gypsy, had been born with any talent, her mother would never have had another child. She would have had what she had wanted. But the second child, June, was the one who was talented. And I really think that when you say born out of necessity, it was necessary for Rose Hovick's mental health, such as it was, for her not to be at home and for her to sort of indulge this and see how far she could go with it. And it was quite a remarkable success. You know, Dainty June was headlining one of the most popular vaudeville acts in the country at the time. There was a point where she was making about $2,500 an act, which was an astronomical sum of money, about $32,000 in today's dollars. Rose wasn't completely unfounded with deciding that June belonged on the stage.
Then the big problem came for Rose, I guess, was when June ran off. She apparently had it and ran off with the boy that was part of the act.
Yeah, you know, it was vaudeville was suffering. Vaudeville took quite a few hits. One of them was the advances in film. With 1927 and the release of The Jazz Singer with Al Jolson, people suddenly became fascinated with talking pictures, and they became all the rage. And even a lot of really popular vaudevillians, you know, the Marx Brothers, started making forays into film and left vaudeville. And so the art form was suffering, and Rose refused to believe that vaudeville was going to die. But June knew better and knew that the end of the road was clear.
Hmm. She went on and performed under the name of June Havoc and actually had a very successful career. She was in some movies. She was in Pal Joey on Broadway. So she actually did quite well for herself.
She did, and it was after a very long road. You know, some of the most interesting research was in vaudeville. I could talk about vaudeville for a while. And also marathon dancing. You know, June spent quite a bit of time doing marathon dancing, which was just this own sordid burlesque, thousands of people crowding into an arena to watch these teenagers standing on their feet for months and months at a time, some of them going mentally ill, squirrely, as the term was, some of them actually dying on the dance floor. It was this horrible torture just so these poor kids had something to eat. And June did that for quite a while before finding any success on Broadway.
She just died last year, and it's been, I think, less than a year since she passed away. And you had the end of her life. You had the opportunity to meet her and spend some time talking with her. Tell us about the experience.
Oh, you know, it was every writer dreams of finding, you know, having this kind of source material available. This is primary source material. June Havoc was 95 years old when I spoke with her, and she's the only one in the world who knew Gypsy back in 1930, who was still living, who had seen Gypsy perform at Minsky's Burlesque in the 1930s, and who actually was from vaudeville. I mean, she was a living relic, and talking with her was like time traveling back to the 1920s. And she was really candid. You know, I was surprised with how candid she was. Talking about her very complicated relationship with her sister and with her mother, and how, you know, she and Gypsy had a very tumultuous relationship of their own, and which is, I go into in the book, and a lot of really heartbreaking stories. When she was down and out and on the marathon dance circuit, Gypsy was the talk of the town in New York. Gypsy was working at Minsky's Burlesque in Times Square. You know, 11,000 people a week were coming to see Gypsy at Minsky's Burlesque in Times Square. And so there was this tremendous role reversal. It really caused a lot of conflict with the sisters. You know, June asked Gypsy for some help, and Gypsy's brand of help was not always maybe what her sister had in mind.
Yeah. Well, I think that I'm sure she would have said that Gypsy's version of things wasn't exactly the way she remembered it. And she did, in fact, write a couple of books herself about about her life and about their life.
Yeah, and you know, all of the Hovick women, I mean, they were all great storytellers, and they were all great embellishers, and I had to keep that in mind at all times. You know, all the memories are subjective, and everybody has their own version, and I had to keep that in mind. But like I said, you know, this is primary source material and invaluable stories that nobody else would have been able to tell me, and I was really incredibly fortunate to hear, you know, some of what really happened with between June and Gypsy, things that would never have gotten into Gypsy's memoir, never have been portrayed on the Broadway musical.
Tell us some more about vaudeville. I'm not sure again what sort of associations people have with that clearly at one time vaudeville in this country was hugely, hugely popular, and some people who performed in vaudeville, that was their platform. They went on, and then they were big in radio and also in movies up until the time that vaudeville really died out. What's the essence of vaudeville? What is it all about?
Well, vaudeville, you know, like I said, I was endlessly fascinated. You know, it was sort of struck me that it was like the reality TV of the 1920s. Only back then, people actually had to work at being famous. You didn't just have to get drunk and get into a couple fights and roll around in hot tubs. You actually had to work at it. But even if you couldn't sing or dance, if you found some strange ability and if you honed it and practiced it enough, you know, you could justify charging people to watch you, and you could become rich and famous. And one of my favorite vaudeville performers was a man by the name of the Amazing Regurgitator. And for his grand finale, he would have his assistant set up a small metal castle on stage, and he would guzzle down a gallon of water followed by a pint of kerosene. And to the accompaniment of a drum roll, he would eject the kerosene in this great six-foot arc and ignite the tiny castle in flames. And the crowd would start freaking out and ooing and aahing and worrying that the theater was going to burn down. And he would calm them down, and then he would eject the water and extinguish the fire. And so this was one of the great vaudeville acts, the Amazing Regurgitator. If anybody actually wants to see this very act live, I have a video clip of it on my website, and it's really something to watch.
Man, they don't make them like that anymore, do they?
No.
Well, what happened to end vaudeville, and then what about this transition between vaudeville and burlesque?
Well, it was, as I said before, a lot of the decline in vaudeville was due to the advances in film. But the other big blow was the onset of the Great Depression, the stock market crash. And suddenly, you know, almost overnight, the country's mood changed, and they were no longer sort of interested in the sunny, mindless optimism of vaudeville. And the country wanted something darker and something more suited to its new mood. And burlesque fit that bill perfectly. And, you know, unemployed men would start lining up in the mornings to get into the evening burlesque shows. And I think they felt a certain camaraderie with the performers. You know, men and women the men and the performers were equally vulnerable and equally naked. And I think that was a comfort on both sides. And all of the girls who were chorus girls on Broadway, you know, people were losing their jobs on Broadway. In fact, burlesque was the only form of entertainment that was booming during the Depression. Burlesque thrived on the Depression. And suddenly these very pretty girls were available at burlesque wages, and they were all leaving the Broadway shows that were closing and going into burlesque. Contributed to it too. And the more girls that were entering burlesque, the more pressure there was to be more and more risky with the acts and risque. And so it just sort of fed on itself.
Well, this, at the point where the act sort of fell apart, because the act was really all June. It was all about June. So when she left, then here was Gypsy. And she didn't have the talent that her younger sister had, couldn't sing, couldn't dance. So I think it seems that there are a lot of stories about how it is that she started taking her clothes off, and whether that was something that she did because she had to do, or because it was some kind of accident, or that it was also some sort of work of genius where she discovered this was something that she could do better than anybody else or different than anybody else, and that was her ticket to stardom. I suppose it depends upon who you ask how this whole thing got started.
Yeah. Well, in the memoir and in the musical, Gypsy presents the version that her mother pushed her into burlesque. Her mother pushed her into stripping, which I don't think is entirely true. You know, they were desperate. Here, mother and daughter, you know, trying to stay in vaudeville. It's not succeeding. Vaudeville is dead. And something had to give. And Gypsy realized this and accepted this before her mother did. And, you know, they had that desperate year where they were eating dog food and going into stripping. And I think that was out of necessity. They had to eat to survive, and this was the only thing that they knew. This was their entire lives. I mean, Gypsy was not a formally educated person, and, you know, she didn't have any other skills to speak of. And so it was a necessity there. But where the genius came in was when she started developing that intellectual persona and that patter with the audience. And when she decided she was going to be the stripper that took 15 minutes to peel off a single glove, while everybody else, you know, everybody else was very overt sexually and bumping and grinding right up against the audience, Gypsy decided at, you know, at that later point, that she was going to stand up against the velvet curtain and be tall and regal and unobtainable and be coy and say things like, oh, boys, I can't take that off. I'll catch cold. And the little witticisms she would drop in. So that was where the genius and the invention came from. But before that, I think it was entirely born out of necessity and you know, just a desperate need to survive.
Mm. What it, even though I guess she has, she had, did appear on film, that somehow it, what she did or who she was didn't really translate to film very well. And unlike her sister, who was a successful actress on the stage, and then she worked in film and she worked in television, why didn't she become a big movie star?
That's an interesting question, and I think it boils down to that very complicated relationship Gypsy had with her creation. And you know, she loved her creation. It gave her money, fame, success. Distance from her mother eventually, all these things that she desperately needed. But it was also a source of frustration for her, and she loathed its limitations, and she sort of lived in this exquisite trap she herself had set. And so when she tries to go out to Hollywood and play another character, she fails. The only character she could play was Gypsy Rose Lee. And so she's out there, and she's not allowed to use her name. They because of the protest from Middle America, she had to use her given name, Louise Hovick. She's not allowed to use her name. She's not allowed to striptease, and she's not allowed to use her sex, her comedy, her sex, you know, comedy that was based in sexual innuendo and her intellectual sexual comedy. So she's not allowed to do any of the things that made Gypsy Rose Lee the creation famous. And so she's left to play a character, and she can't play another character besides Gypsy Rose Lee. And I think that was the crux of her failure in Hollywood.
She was associated with some celebrated mogul types in Hollywood, one being Mike Todd, a guy who now maybe is really known for two things, one for having been married to Elizabeth Taylor, the other for having been the guy behind the production of the film Around the World in 80 Days. And he probably would have done a lot more, but he died relatively young. He died in a plane crash.
Yeah.
Tell us about the relationship between Gypsy and Mike Todd.
Well, I spoke with June Havoc quite a bit about their relationship, and she said it was money at first sight. So I love that. And that they immediately understood each other. And Mike Todd was also somebody who was relentlessly self-inventing and somebody who created a character and created a persona. And I think who was also afraid of his past and afraid of going backward. And I think they really understood that about each other. And they met, he hired her to star at the New York World's Fair in 1940. When, of course, she was voted the most popular woman in the world. Gypsy was immediately taken with him, and he with her. But there was a problem. Michael Todd was married and had a young son, and Gypsy would give him ultimatums about leaving his wife. And Michael Todd didn't love his wife, but he loved his son. He was afraid he would never see his son again. So that was a constant source of conflict between them. And one of my favorite scenes in the book is when Gypsy is waiting for to see if Michael Todd will show up and stop her from marrying another man. You know, you'll have to read the book to see what happens there. But it's one of my favorite scenes, and she just really desperately wanted to be with him.
Mm. She also had a relationship with the film director Otto Preminger, and in fact had a son by Otto Preminger.
Yes, and June Havoc also spoke about that. She said that Gypsy said that, I'm going to find the meanest, toughest, smartest son of a bitch in the world. I'm going to have his baby, and my child is going to rule the earth. So with that in mind, she was out in Hollywood, and she made a beeline for Otto Preminger at a party and very calculatedly decided to court him and have his child. And she never told Otto Preminger that she was pregnant. He found out quite by accident. And she was determined to raise her son on his own. Her son grew up not even knowing that Otto Preminger was his father.
And how did you talk to him? What did he think of his mother and the circumstances of his being created?
Well, you know, he did say that he was disappointed at one point that he found out it wasn't Michael Todd. He always suspected it was Michael Todd. When he was about 18 years old, he finally said, you know, Mother, tell me who my father is. And Gypsy's response was to light a cigarette and look at him and say, "It's none of your business," which was the classical Gypsy answer. She eventually relented, but I love that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Karen Abbott, and we are talking about the life and times of Gypsy Rose Lee. That is the subject of her recent book, American Rose. And it is recently out from Random House. Given another of the things that is just amazing about her, given the circumstances of her growing up and the fact that as Rose was dragging the girls around the country, they never spent any time in school, that she would grow up to be someone who had literary aspirations, if you can call writing popular fiction that, at which she succeeded, and also was close friends with a lot of people who were very celebrated writers of the time.
Yeah, I mean, for a while, Gypsy even lived in a writer's community, a writer's salon in Brooklyn. And she was there with some of the most famous, writers of the time, W.H. Auden, Benjamin Britten, George Davis, who was the fiction editor at Harper's Bazaar, and even Carson McCullers, who was working on the book that would become The Member of the Wedding at that time. And she and Gypsy became particularly close, and it was rumored that they even had a fling. And Gypsy went there to work on her first novel. It was called The G-String Murders. And it was a murder mystery in which the weapon of choice was a G-string. And she got a contract with Simon & Schuster, and she was determined to make this book a success. And I love this line. She told her publicist, "I will do my striptease in a Macy's window to sell a book. If you want something a bit classier, make it a Wanamaker's window." But she was determined to succeed in that realm. And she was self-taught. You know, she did not have a lot of formal education, but she read voraciously as a kid on the vaudeville circuit, and continued to be a voracious reader all through adulthood and in many subjects. She was actually very well read.
Have you read The G-String Murders? What kind of book is it?
It's a potboiler, and it's very heavily drawn from her experience in burlesque and based on Minsky's Republic and based on the people there, and it's a great read. It's fun.
So what was it that attracted her to these kind of people? I mean, not the show business people, but the literary people.
I think it was she had a desire to be known for that. She did not like taking off her clothes. When it came down to it, she did not like being a stripteaser. It was a means to an end. And with that in mind, she sort of put everything else into stripteasing that she could think of to elevate it. The best way she could do that was to become known as the intellectual stripteaser. And she succeeded at that. You know, the Algonquin Roundtable was fans of hers. H.L. Mencken coined the word ecdesiast in her honor. And she just, I think, really wanted to sort of be known as the stripteaser with a brain and with a wit. And so with that in mind, very carefully cultivated these relationship with these people and would throw these very famous parties and invite all of them. And there was one scene in the book where she attended a publishing party, and this is early on in her career, and she was there with John Farr, who, you know, eventually would go on to found Farr, Straus, and Giroux. And she's talking about The Good Earth, which Pearl S. Buck had just published, and she was holding forth on this better than anyone else in the room, and sort of that. That's where it all began.
I had to look up ecdesiast and it has something to do with molting.
Or casting off.
So it has at Mencken. You know, he was a man who had a way with words, so he applied it to this taking off of clothes. I'm not exactly sure how I feel about molting as a metaphor. If that's exactly all unattractive, but it certainly attracted his attention.
Yeah, and Gypsy, of course, would use that to great publicity. She made a fight, you know, she started a fight with Mencken in the press, and she said, "Ecdesiast, he calls me. What a man, the snob that man is. I read his stuff, but I only read it in my youth," you know, and she would say that, things like that, and sort of get a war of words going in the press, and she just loved that and ate it up.
Yeah. Well, we have maybe about 8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Karen Abbott. We're talking about the life of Gypsy Rose Lee. That is the subject of her recently published book, American Rose. It's published by Random House. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, she had this remarkable life. She was very celebrated. She got to hang out with a lot of glittering people, both both from the world of show business and the literary world. Did she consider herself to be a success, do you think?
I think she absolutely did, in a way that she considered Gypsy Rose Lee, the creation, to be a success. She did not consider her attempts to expand the parameters of Gypsy Rose Lee, the creation, to be a success. You know, she said one thing to her sister, to June, that was very telling. You know, June, she was asking June what June thought of her performance in Du Barry Was a Lady. Gypsy had briefly replaced Ethel Merman. And June just looked at her sister and said, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, but you really couldn't sing. And Gypsy, you know, bristled at this, and she said, well, June, when you're Gypsy Rose Lee, you don't have to sing. You just have to keep up your strength to carry your money to the bank.
We have a caller here to talk with in Champaign, line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is kind of a minor question, but where does the term G-string come from? What's the G stand for?
Oh, that's a good question. One of the theories about that was that it was named for the lowest string in a violin, I believe.
Ah, okay.
I'm trying to remember that from my research. Yeah, it was named for one of the strings of a violin.
And what's that relevance then to
I guess the lowest body. String that it was the G string being the lowest, you know, I guess the lowest string.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it doesn't quite make sense, but that's the etymology from what I understand.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, you can send us an email if you like. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. We had a call from somebody a little bit earlier who remembered seeing her on television when she had a television talk show, and the caller said she thought she was really good at it. She really came across very well. How did that come about?
She, you know, actually Joe Franklin, who was an old sort of legendary talk show host in his own right, told me that Gypsy, he and Gypsy were friends, and she got the idea from him. She lived in Los Angeles, but would travel down to San Francisco a couple times a week to do her tapings. And there's a couple scenes in the book about this and how she would insist on being flown first class because she always had her materials with her and would refuse to check any of them. But I think she did get the idea from another talk show host friend.
We have another caller here to talk with in Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, I kept quiet because I'm a fan of Gypsy Rose Lee. The novel, The G-String, I was trying to find out whether she did it all by herself or was there some ghostwriting or was there some serious helping from the publisher or was it essentially her book? Thanks.
Well, that's a great question. And I know that she had quite a bit of editing help. George Davis, who was living at the Brooklyn Writers Colony with Gypsy, was her editor there. And they began actually with Gypsy telling stories, and he would take them down. And he would sort of formulate these stories for her. And then she tried to write herself from there. And she also had quite a bit of help from a fiction from a novelist named Craig Rice, who was another murder mystery novelist. And a lot of people think that Craig Rice penned Gypsy's books. I don't think that's true. I think that Gypsy had quite a bit of editing help, but I do think Gypsy had too much pride to let somebody else entirely write her book and then to put her own name on it. I don't think she would have allowed that. But Gypsy was a masterful storyteller, but not, you know, formally trained writer. So oh. I do think that all the storytelling was her own, but she had quite a bit of help with the editing and with sort of structuring and polishing it up.
I'm sure that in this case, maybe it's always the case when you're doing biography, at least when someone has left some kind of a record in their own voice, is to sort through the version of their story that they would like you to have and to get down to the version that was real, what really happened. And in her particular case, and she was one of these people, as we've said, it was really known for creating a character that then she embodied and wanting you to have a particular kind of version of what had happened. Do you feel that you've actually gotten somewhere close to the real Gypsy?
I do, and the reason I do is because I think, you know, what is the heart of a person? And to me, one of the, you know, to know somebody is to know what would be the one thought or the one, you know, fear that would keep them up at night. And I think that I found that out with Gypsy, and that's something that, you know, is at the core of a person. And the fact that she actually did not like her creation and in the end wasn't entirely happy with what she had made, and I think thought about this constantly, and it tortured her on some level and saddened her on some level. I think that was really one of the deepest pieces of who she was.
Hmm. Well, so what was it that she was unhappy about?
I think she was unhappy. One of the things, you know, and June told me this story, which really put a lot of the pieces of the puzzle together. She said that Gypsy would go on an interview and she'd want to be talking about her play or her novel or maybe her talk show or anything. And people would ask her to take off her gloves. You know, it had nothing to do with the conversation. It was completely irrelevant to what was the topic at hand. And they would ask her to take off her gloves. And Gypsy would do it. And then June said she would go back to the dressing room and she would cry. And she just was upset that no matter what she wanted to speak about, no matter how intelligent she was, there was always an element of leering and an element where suddenly they were demanding something from her that she was really tired of giving. That was something that I think, you know, was a source of frustration and sadness to her till the day she died.
Yeah. So that was it was the thing that made her.
Yeah.
But then it was something she clearly wanted to rise above and get beyond. And because perhaps that was the thing that made her, it sounds that like a lot of people just wouldn't let her.
They wouldn't
let go of it.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We just have a couple of minutes left. And, you know, I'm sure always in interviews like this, writers are, you know, spend time talking about whatever it is they've done. And then, of course, the question comes, so what are you working on now? And it's something that I know writers don't really like to talk all that much about. They maybe give you little hints, a la Gypsy, but they don't really want to tell you the whole deal. But let me ask you, what kind of thing is maybe you think you'll be writing about for your next project?
I just sold my third book, so that was a nice relief. And it's about the Civil War, and it's about female Civil War spies, two who work for the Union and two who work for the Confederacy.
And this is nonfiction?
Yeah, nonfiction.
Well, that's interesting. What, is there something about, generally speaking, that particular time, you know, like late 19th, early 20th century, that you find interesting or appealing or compelling?
My background's in journalism, so I never dwelled in the past, and I was always just more drawn to story. It just so happened that the first story that I was really enthralled by happened to take place in Chicago around the turn of the century, and ever since then I've sort of become a history buff and fallen in love with history and find nothing more enjoyable than to spend a day in musty old archives getting lost in the words of people who have been dead for decades, if not a century.
Yeah.
And it's just dead people are interesting. They don't always say what you want them to say, but it's piecing together their stories is just something I hope to be able to, you know, do for quite a while.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the reasons that particular time of history is interesting is that it has one foot in each world. That is, in some ways, it seems modern and you can relate to those people, and then they'll turn right around and do something that seems like they truly are people out of another age. And then you think, no, I'm not sure that I can relate to those people.
Yeah, I think at the core, people are the same. People want the same things. They want happiness. They want fulfillment. They want love. They want success. They want, I think there's a common denominator just among humanity with a lot of factors. But of course, you know, the conditions of the time and the mores of the time and the societal expectations of the time shape all of that. And so it's sort of really interesting to see where those are in flux and where how they changed and who changed the times. And I'm very particularly drawn to women who were ahead of their time and sort of revolutionaries in their own way and who were seen as subversive and not necessarily upstanding citizens during their day necessarily, but who really, you know, in essence, were you know, misunderstood and you know, definitely worthy of a second look.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. The book is American Rose, Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee, published by Random House, by our guest, Karen Abbott. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn incorporates residents' past routines and interests into their daily lives, engaging residents in choices and daily living patterns. More information is available at 384-0100.
I'm Tom Rogers. The afternoon magazine begins after a look at the commodity markets and NPR News. Corn futures have rallied as wet weather was expected to stall plantings. Wheat was up on poor crop conditions in the plains. Soybeans have been pulled up by wheat and corn, and slower than average plantings reported there, too. Right now in Kansas City, the May wheat contract is up 35.5 cents at 945.5. The July at 933.5 up 19.